opportunity presented to me because of years of hard work. And then it looked for a horrifying few minutes as if that opportunity was going to vanish forever. On our first morning in Vancouver for Game 3, I get a call at 9:30 from the Wings GM, Ken Holland, telling me to meet him in the restaurant downstairs ASAP. I think, holy shit, they're putting me in for Game 3. "Hi, Mr. Holland," I say, greeting the guy with the ultimate power over my career, to which he quickly replies, "Cut the shit. You know the guys call me Kenny." Ken Holland had a great relationship with almost every single player who's been part of the Red Wings core over the years. And one of the reasons for this was that he didn't lie or bullshit them. This is a rare trait among NHL general managers, who would lie to their own mothers about being their sons if it meant they could keep their jobs. So many of them had permanently chapped lips because of all the ass they'd kissed along the way. So just as I'm thinking the good guy Ken is going to tell me I'm dressing for Game 3, he surprises the hell out of me by barking, "What the fuck did you do last night?" "I was in my room as soon as we got to the hotel," I reply, suddenly feeling not like the game buster I imagined I would be, but some sniveling kid in the principal's office. For a moment, I even think to myself, Jesus, did I go out last night and just can't remember? Holland looks like he's already sentenced me to death. "I got a call from the owner of your complex in Detroit who said your motherfucking buddies broke your front door down and proceeded to destroy everything in sight and were running around naked with a bunch of broads. Note, all NHL GMs refer to any women their players are fucking, except for their wives, as broads." I told him I had no idea what happened, and I would kick my friends out immediately and pay for any damage. At this point, my eyes are starting to fill with tears. I've never been this scared in my entire life, and there's also the gut punch feeling that I've let down the guy who's given me the thing I've put every ounce of my soul into achieving since I was 8 years old. I'm wondering if I just ruined my life. Holland told me it was the last time anything like this could happen, or else I'd be finished. I believed every word that came out of his mouth that morning, and I could have wept with relief that I wasn't finished yet. He'd given me a second chance. Game 3 did not include me leading the team to a glorious comeback in the famous winged wheel sweater, and honestly, that was fine, as I was still too hurt to play. But the way things turned out in that quarterfinal series against Vancouver shows what big-time veterans we had on that team, guys who played even better in big-time situations. We won Game 3 in Vancouver because of one of the flukiest plays I've ever seen. It was at a point in the series where, if we'd lost the game, we were probably done. We were tied at one goal apiece with 30 seconds left in the second period when Nick Lidstrom skated the puck out of our zone, and just before he hit center ice, fired it toward the Vancouver goal. It was a knuckler, and it dipped right underneath Canuck goalie Dan Cloutier's glove. You could hear the wind being sucked out of the arena, and the Canuckleheads and their team. We won 3-1, and the Canucks never won another game in that series. I ended up playing with Dan Cloutier towards the end of his career in L.A. I'd always heard rumors that he was tough, and for a goalie to be tough is like a baseball pitcher being a great hitter. But it was true. Dan Cloutier had 3 fights in the NHL and 1 in the AHL, and for a goalie, that's like being a rabid dog. He had crystal blue eyes and Clark Kent looks. But he was really a fucking savage inside. That goal he let in was something that could happen to anyone. And a good team shrugs it off and comes out harder. It was largely Dan's play that got the Canucks into the playoffs in the first place. He won 31 games that season, posted 7 shutouts, and went 7-0-1 down the stretch. So they definitely overachieved going up 2-0 on us. And when that fluky goal went in, the Canucks looked in the mirror and we looked forward to our next opponent, the St. Louis Blues. We knocked the Blues off in 5 games. We'd won 8 of our last 9. I can feel the momentum rising in the room, and now we're halfway to the 16 wins needed for the Cup. Standing in our way to the final are the evil Colorado Avalanche. Because I looked up so much to the guys on Detroit, I inherited their hate-on for Colorado, which started with Claude Lemieux's nasty, nasty hit on Chris Draper in the 1996 Western Conference Final. Lemieux checked Draper face-first into the Dasher boards and got 5 and a 2-game suspension, while Drapes, who had a concussion, a broken jaw, broken nose, and broken cheekbone, got a new face, as the medics pretty much had to rebuild it. The Wings also hated Lemieux because he was hard to play against. He was a very smart defensive player. You could always feel him breathing down your neck, and you knew he was going to finish his check. He was unusual because French-Canadian guys played a skill game and left the tough stuff to others, but not Claude Lemieux. I tried to do my part both times I played against Colorado in 2002. The first game was on February 4th, 2002. I was sitting on the bench doing my usual routine of giving every guy on the other team who skated by a piece of my mind about how they should just resign from humanity. I soon learned there were guys in the league that my Hall of Fame teammates wouldn't allow me to unleash on. Standing at the end of the bench was something I did till the end of my career, because I knew it was annoying to my own team if I was constantly shit-talking while moving up and down the bench until my name was called to hop over the boards. Brett Hall sometimes would stay at the end of the bench when he was pissed off at his line mates for not seeing the play open 16 seconds before it happened, the way he could see it happening. In my first game against the Avalanche, with Holly right next to me, I leaned over to tell Joe Sakic that I'd seen him walking into the arena before the game, and that he should sue the blind thief who sold him his sports coat, and that I wondered how a guy making $8 million a year could dress that badly. I threw in the intel that if our shifts overlapped, I was going to follow him like a Scud missile and blindside his old ass. As those words came out of my mouth, I felt a hand the size of a baseball mitt attached to a wrist the size of a ham pull the back of my jersey onto the bench. I turned to my right and was shocked to realize that it was Brett Hall grabbing me. And then he told me, loud enough for Sakic to hear, "You are never to speak with or to Mr. Sakic in that tone again." It was the first time Brett Hall was pissed at me, and I suddenly understood that certain guys were really, truly off limits. Brett would have been the first to smile if I'd put Mr. Sakic on his ass with a clean hit between whistles. But he was not smiling at the other stuff. So the character of Sean Avery got a major adjustment at that moment. I'd have to find another way to get the future Hall of Famers off their game. After my leg healed, I resumed my daily grind as a black ace, which is the term we use to describe the extra players on a team's roster during the playoffs. Usually these guys get into the lineup at some point. And in Detroit, there were 5 of us who'd spent an additional hour on the ice after the guys in the lineup were finished practicing. The aces would do skating drills, hidden inside shooting drills, which would be followed by a bag skate. This is when you start at your goal line, skate to your blue line, stop. Skate back, stop. Do it again, stop. Skate to the center line, stop. Skate back, stop. Skate to the far blue line, stop. And skate back again. Until you've skated your bags off. Some coaches use it as a punishment. But during the playoffs, conditioning is king. So they want to be sure we're game ready if we get tapped. We'd then finished Black Aces sessions with a 4-on-4 game that also included the assistant coaches, Joey Kosher, Dave Lewis, and Bug-Eyed Barry Smith. Dave Lewis would be our coach the following year, though we didn't know it then, and Barry Smith was another one of Scotty's secret weapons, because he had the same kind of wide-eyed stare that Marty Feldman has. We called him Bug-Eyed Barry, but he didn't notice. You could always talk to Barry about Scotty and feel that he wasn't going to throw you under the Zamboni. Joey Kosher was one of the toughest guys who'd ever played in the NHL. He was a big, strong Saskatchewan farm boy with hands so massive it looked like he could do one-handed curls with bales of hay. He was the hardest-nosed guy I'd ever played with and had over 2,500 penalty minutes to show for it, not to mention 3 Stanley Cups. Joey had recently made the transition from playing to coaching, and he broke down video for us during the playoffs. I remember he was looking rough one morning during practice, which could only mean he'd been out late washing down our latest playoff win. I was getting bored with the daily Black Aces grind, so I had to push through it and work extra hard, which was my way of keeping it fun. One day, I guess Joey didn't like how hard I was working, because after a goal that he'd buried on a rebound, one that he scored when I'd been hooking him, he turned around and open hand punched me in the shoulder and sent me flying backwards 4 feet, easily. And it would have been even further on fresh ice. He hit me so hard that I lost my wind and was looking up at him gasping for air as Bug-Eyed Barry skated by and explained, "Nobody hooks Joey when he's hungover." The series against Colorado was long and tough, with 3 of the first 5 games decided in overtime and Colorado taking a 3-2 lead. But again, I saw firsthand what a championship team can do when push comes to shove. One of the biggest differences between a team that knows how to win and one that doesn't is that the champions buckle down. They all understand that for 2.5 months, everything shuts off. Personal life, social life, your phone between periods, everything. There's total focus. Winners also don't panic when facing adversity. They understand that it's a 7-game series, and the first to win 4 games takes the series. So it takes as long as it takes. And championship teams are able to balance their attack so that every line can get the job done. Fedorov was not going to be dominant every night, but other guys would rise to the occasion. The grind line would step up and win the game, and no one would feel that they'd stolen the superstar's chance to shine. It's very hard to play against a team like this, as Colorado found out. We'd shut them out the next 2 games with a 7-0 emphasis in Game 7 to win the series and a place in the Stanley Cup Final, which we would go on to win in 5 games. There's a story from Game 6 of the Western Conference Final, though, that I don't think has ever been told. So we're facing elimination, and we go up 1-0 on a very strange goal by Shanahan. Patrick Waugh made a showboat Statue of Liberty move after a glove save, but he didn't actually have the puck securely in his trapper as he raised his glove to the ceiling beams. The puck dropped to the ice, and the ever-opportunistic Shanny poked it into the net. Waugh had a reputation of being as hard on his teammates as he was on himself. It's what drove him to be great every night. When we saw him showboating and making an ass of himself, we loved it. He wasn't as much of a Superman as he thought. But even so, he did the same move again about 30 seconds after Shanny scored on him. This time, Shanny tapped him on the pads to congratulate him on not giving up another bad goal. The bench loved it. Then my old pal McCarty intercepts a pass in the defensive zone and goes in on a 2-on-1. The usual play here is the pass for the tap-in, since it's pretty much impossible for any goalie to get across in time for that save. But McCarty winds up and leans into a slapper that beats Waugh cleanly. It's a pretty obvious fuck you to the guy who is supposedly the best goalie in the world. Goalies like that can get inside guys' heads, can get players missing the net are not taking shots at all since they think they have to shoot for the corners. But a shot like McCarty's says, we can score on this guy, and now it's 2-0. So there's 2:23 left in the second period, and Colorado is on a power play, trying to get back in the game and close out this series. Their coach, Bob Hartley, is holding what he thinks is an ace. He calls the ref over and asks for a measurement of our goalie Dominic Hasek's stick. Hartley thinks the goal stick is illegal, and if it is, the Avalanche will have a 2-man advantage at a crucial point in the game. Illegal sticks are very common. Illegal, meaning the blade is too wide, or has too much of a curve, or is too long. In the playoffs, everyone is trying to get an edge, and everyone knows it. So it's like an elaborate game with its own set of rules. Everybody does it. The trick is in the timing. For example, guys play with illegal sticks for most of the game, but also have a legal stick stored on a rack behind the bench. Nobody would dare to make that call in the regular season. You'd be seen as a petty worm. If a team even tried it, there would probably be a bench-clearing brawl. See what I mean about unwritten rules? But if Colorado can win this game, they eliminate us. So Hartley gambles. He never did get his 5-on-3, though. At that moment, Dominic Hasek was using a perfectly legal stick. I mean, he used an illegal stick all the time, but not in that game. Chelly told me that sometime before Game 3, someone from the Avs snuck into our dressing room at the Pepsi Center in Denver with a measuring tape. He confirmed what was probably obvious to the naked eye. Dom's goal stick blade was too wide. So the intel goes into Hartley's file. But he doesn't use it in Game 3. Doesn't use it in Game 4. Doesn't use it in Game 5. Game 6, though, down 2-0, he decides it's time to pull the trigger. What he doesn't know is that sometime before the game, the locker attendant assigned to our dressing room decided he didn't like this spycraft. He pulled Chelly aside and told him what was being planned. Chelly warned Dom, and the illegal stick was left in the room when Hasek hit the ice. As hockey fans know, there's also a 2-minute penalty for asking for a stick measurement if the stick turns out to be legit. Hasek got a shutout with his legal stick as we won the game 2-0. I think Chelly ended up giving the room attendant some form of paper thank you, which was thanked but not accepted. We call that the love of the game. Chapter 6. Stanley Cup Summer. I never did play again that year. Did I feel sorry for myself that my leg blew up a few days before the playoffs started? Not at all. Any idea how many minor hockey players actually have a career in the NHL? About 0.002% of them. And how many of those win the Stanley Cup their first year in the league? You get the point. I wasn't moping around the Wings dressing room. I'd just won the fucking lottery. It was pretty much a blur from then until the Stanley Cup parade. I used to drink alcohol like most hockey players. Yeah, 22-year-olds like to drink. And yeah, Canadians know how to put away some beers. That's the baseline. Pro hockey players are in another league altogether. It seemed to me that the best players in the world are the guys who like to throw them back the most. Sort of like some genius artists who need to lose themselves in booze and drugs once they've finished creating art. It's as if reality just isn't interesting enough. But despite what you might expect from me, I'm not a booze hound. True confession, I don't really like the taste of alcohol. I'm more of a dry vices kind of guy. But firing up a joint wasn't really an option around the NHL. I remember the afternoon before the Stanley Cup parade when Chelly said he was coming to pick me up so that we could go out and get relaxed before the city showered us with adulation and more booze. I have a major league sweet tooth. So I poured myself half a glass of Amaretto and half a glass of Dr. Pepper and slugged it back to get a protective little buzz going. There was absolutely no way I was going to keep up with Chelly. Chelly was a beer guy to start, and then he'd get into tequila or Jameson, and then he'd black out. When he got really bad, you'd have to carry him out of the place, or he'd just sleep there. Then he'd wake up in the morning and shake the dust off and go to the rink, and he'd be the hardest working guy in practice. Clone his DNA, and you'd have a race of supermen. So the day before the Stanley Cup parade in 2002, we went over to Eminem's house with Lord Stanley's jug. Eminem lived in a rich suburb of Detroit in the biggest house I'd ever seen. He didn't have gold lions or a shark in the pool or anything like that. It was just this massive house and him. I don't know how we ended up there or who set it up, but the whole thing was really awkward. Actually, as Eminem didn't know anything about hockey. It was really more like a photo op for everyone. He'd just become famous, and he had a lot of hardcore hip-hop guys hanging around. When you meet famous people, it always cuts one of two ways. Either they wish they were professional athletes, or they don't care about sports at all. Eminem was the latter. So I left Eminem's place to run around town with Chelly, and then Sergei Fedorov joined us. And we ended up at my townhouse overlooking the mighty and beautiful Detroit River. I'd moved into the condo from the hotel after I'd made the Wings for good. And my mom, Marlene, and father, Al, had come down to see their boy celebrate his team's Stanley Cup championship. Chelly's the kind of guy who could sit down and have a beer with my dad and me, and it would seem completely normal. Because it was. No one was pretending to be someone else. I was very glad that my parents were staying with me, because I was conked out on the bathroom floor when my mother woke me up at 9 a.m. on the day of the parade. Fortunately for both Marlene and myself, I was in my tidy whities, but I had no idea how I wound up on the bathroom floor. Well, I did, but no specific memory of what had happened. And now I realize to my horror that I was late to the Stanley Cup parade. My head was a swamp. Just getting out the door was going to be an accomplishment. It's not like they were going to delay the parade until I arrived. So I thought that I'd just sneak onto a float or car when I caught up with it. But the parade was running late too, so I made it in the end. They gave us each our own car to ride in, a Thunderbird convertible. And I brought Leslie, who ran the family room for the Red Wings, along with me, because that's the kind of atmosphere the Wings created, and I thought she should be there. Ford had launched their retro Thunderbird model earlier that year, but they put Scotty in the original car from 1955. We were all chauffeured down Woodward Avenue from Hockey Town, a bar that the Red Wings owner, Mike Ilitch, built across from Comerica Park. It was a short parade, just the 1 mile down Woodward into Hart Plaza, where they had set up a stage. I had no idea what a Stanley Cup parade was like. There were 2 million people in downtown Detroit, all there because of us. I had never seen that many people in one place. The plaza was packed, and the sun was hot, and I was guzzling water from a bottle just to keep myself from passing out. But when I was introduced to the crowd as one of the Black Aces by the announcer, and he said that they were going to be hearing a lot more from us, I felt as if I'd played every single playoff game for the Wings and scored the cup winner. It was a thrill like I had never experienced, and it was also overwhelming. The noise, the people, and the fact that the Stanley Cup was the reason for it all was just staggering to me, because I was still a fan. So you could say I was a fan at my own Stanley Cup parade, and that's what I remember most about it. Watching me, watching it, all in awe. I didn't even think of all those people who told me I'd never make it. I just thought about next season and winning this thing again. Of course, I never would win it again. But that's the nature of the beast. When you're 22, you think you're immortal and that the Stanley Cup is yours for the taking every season. But those seasons go by fast, and that cup is very, very hard to win. So looking back, I'm very glad that I made it to that parade because there wouldn't be any others. A few days later, I'm working out with Drapes at a gym in Detroit when he mentions that he's going to New York to model tuxedos. Oh, and he signed me up too. I didn't know there was such a thing as Wedding Week on Good Morning America, but suddenly I was part of it. This is so surreal on so many levels that I just say, sure. By the way, no one minds being told that they have what it takes to be a model. As it turned out, I was a model on TV for all of about 20 seconds on that trip. No one on set cared about Sean Avery or Chris Draper, and there was no small talk about the Stanley Cup. Why the team or the league wanted us there, I have no idea. But I learned a lot from being on the other side of the camera. Strutting around under the TV lights, I realized there was no way anyone watching Good Morning America would have any idea what I was thinking. You can't figure someone out by watching them on television. In that moment, I understood the complete rift between what someone looks like and who they really are. It occurred to me that models always looked like they got their shit together, but that was not how I was feeling. Even for a guy who'd spent the previous year jetting around and staying in luxury hotels, the St. Regis off Madison Avenue was a cut above. It made me realize that I was still just a suburban kid figuring out this world. Even the prostitutes were elite. Not the usual suicide blonde draped in too much faux gold, but more like a hot pharmaceutical rep waiting for a meeting. I had the same experience walking around Soho, which is the coolest part of New York, with its cobblestone streets and old loft-style buildings that rise up six stories. The people walking the streets are different here than in Detroit or Scarborough. They just seem so confident, as if they each own a piece of this amazing city. I don't mean real estate, but the anything is possible sense of the place. I mean, if you walked around dressed in black from top to bottom in Scarborough or the Motor City, people would offer their condolences and ask where the funeral was happening. But in New York, it looks clean and elegant. I had to admit, it was sort of intimidating. I may have looked like a model that day, but I knew I was the same guy who had to wear two undershirts after gym class to stop the sweat from seeping out. Part of my job is to figure other people out, and you can't do that if you bullshit yourself. I wasn't walking around Manhattan feeling like a big shot. I was taking notes on all I had to learn if I wanted to fit in here. Well, maybe more than just fit in. As I walk back to the hotel from Columbus Circle after the GMA gig, I see, in my mind's eye, a billboard with my face on it. I feel like I've just taken the smallest peek into the mind of New York. Now that I've glimpsed its power and passion and its massive scale of possibility, I want to come back and stay longer so that I can see how far I can push myself. I also remember realizing that the NHL had no idea how to promote itself. No idea. We'd just been on network television, and no one even mentioned our names. Only people who already knew us would have cared. That's how the NHL is. Only people who already care about it will watch it. If you want to grow, and that's what businesses are supposed to want, right? Then what you need are personalities, heroes, villains, people for the fans to focus on. But the NHL is no good at creating character. So, if I want attention, then I'll have to create a character for myself. Not long after my first modeling gig, I was on a plane again with Chris Draper. He and his wife Julie and I flew out to Los Angeles to go to Chelly's Stanley Cup party at his beachfront headquarters in Malibu. Chelly and I were the same kind of social animal and were drawn to each other. He hung out with me because I was always available and I could keep the insane hours that he kept. He was energized by my energy, and I was energized by his diverse interests. We stayed at the W Hotel in Brentwood, which was close to Luc Robitaille's house, which he'd kept after being traded to Detroit in 2001 after 12 seasons with the Kings, and a couple with the Rangers and one with Pittsburgh. Luke would go back to LA in 2004. Luke was having his Stanley Cup party on the Friday night, so we had the weekend pretty much covered. Luke's party was a total family affair, with guys and their wives and girlfriends and parents and kids. He had an In-N-Out burger truck in his driveway during the party. All I knew at the time was that I'd stepped into a much bigger world than the one I knew, and Detroit was already huge compared to the world I'd come from. Jerry Bruckheimer is at Luke's party, and Bruce McNall and Chad Lowe, Rob's brother. Luke's wife, Stacia, is a former Laker girl, cheerleader for the basketball team, and a lot of her nicely turned out girlfriends are in attendance. So I'm partying with a bunch of celebrities and NBA cheerleaders and taking it all in, because I don't fit in. Not even close. I was wearing a golf shirt, tucked in, with jeans and loafers. To all those fine SoCal babes who were there, I looked like a hockey player who had some money, but no idea what to do with it. If I was 5 years older and more experienced, I'd have had the pick of the litter. But I'm still a rookie, and if the lady hasn't worn a jersey to some sort of sporting event in her life, then right now, I probably don't have a shot. It's also my first time in Malibu. With the drive from Westwood down Sunset Boulevard to the ocean, and then along the Pacific Coast Highway, or PCH to those who know her well. Feeling like it's straight out of a movie, which of course it has been, many times. It's a little like being on set again, and it gets me thinking the way I had been back in New York. Another city I really only knew from the movies and cop shows. Seeing yourself in a place you always kind of imagined as fake and realizing it's real gives you a whole new sense of what's possible. I mean, these gleaming beachfront homes of glass and steel, they're real. If I work hard, I can have one. My friend has one. It's the same thing with the guest list. Rocky was at Chelly's party, as in Sly fucking Stallone. Here at the same party as Sean Avery from Scarborough, Ontario. So are Hilary Swank and Tom Hanks and Kid Rock and Cuba Gooding. Wayne Gretzky is here. As I walk down to the beach, I meet two magnificent human specimens, and I recognize the incredibly beautiful 5'11 brunette, a cross between a Greek goddess and the sexiest all-American girl from small-town Oklahoma as Gabby Reese. She is the most famous pro volleyball player in the history of the sport, and she's married to the most famous big-wave surfer on the planet, and probably the best-looking man I've ever seen, Laird Hamilton. They're having a conversation that's so animated and joyful, it seems like they just met. But because it was Chelly, it was a family beach party with the Stanley Cup. There were kids romping in the water and people hanging out in lounge chairs soaking up the sun and some beers, and the vibe was very friendly and earthy, even if the star power was high. Watching the waves come in, I wasn't congratulating myself for having made it this far. Trust me, I knew I wasn't Chris Chelios. But seeing all this, seeing this world and the people in it, made me realize just how much is possible. More than ever, I wanted to figure this all out. I wanted to be part of this world. Hard work separates those who truly rise above and stand out from those who merely get by. Not hard work is in showing up to the same job on time for 27 years, which is a fine thing and absolutely an achievement if you can find an employer that will keep you for nearly 3 decades without outsourcing you. I mean the kind of hard work that leaves you alone at night while your college peers are doing keg stands and your grown-up friends are taking a well-earned breather. I mean the kind of hard work that most people just won't do. That takes desire. Raw, unstoppable desire. Driving back to the hotel in LA, I look at the Pacific Ocean lit by the moon and stretching off into forever, and I know that desire is not going to be a problem. After Chelly's party, I flew home to Toronto and used the roughly $20,000 bonus that each Red Wing received for winning the President's Trophy to rent a house in the East End neighborhood of Toronto known as the Beaches. 10 years earlier, while strolling through the beaches with my mom and dad, I told them that when I made the NHL, I was going to buy a house there and have them over for dinner. But they'd have to go home afterward because I was going to be with my friends. I was 12 years old when I made this grand pronouncement. That summer was as good as it gets for a 22-year-old guy. I had two of my best friends living with me, guys I'd played junior hockey with who were hoping to land in the NHL. And from Monday through Thursday, we had a fairly standard routine. 6 a.m. wake up, followed by a track or a gym workout from 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. A quarter mile is one full lap around a track, which is also 400 meters. For 12 years, quarter-mile runs, and I mean runs, we'd do them in 90 seconds, were an integral part of my summer training. They provided me and my training partner, Chris Draper, with a tool to push ourselves and each other to become stronger and stronger year after year. We'd run a quarter, then move on to the next one, and onward until we'd done 10. When your heart rate hits 195 beats per minute, the dry heaves or outright pukes would start. Drapes and I had some epic battles on the track in those summers, and that training and the pain of it were critical for me becoming an NHL player. Of course, once the run was done, my buddies and I would hit the gym for a couple hours to lift weights. One thing hockey players do is take a bar that you'd bench press with and power clean it. So you lift 145 pounds above your head, then drop the bar onto your shoulder, then jump up onto boxes 3 feet high, then jump back down. We'd do 8 of those box jumps. After knocking off a Thursday, we'd head to Muskoka, which is Ontario's famous lake district. We'd stay either near the Quay in Bala or at the Sherwood Inn on Lake Joe, with either place soon turning into Animal House. Bala is a tiny town on a huge lake 3 hours from the nearest city. But the Quay is a legend. I mean, Drake, Rush, the Ramones, Snoop Dogg, and tons of huge bands have played in this little bar. That's how good the party is. We would go to all the local lake bars, and because Canada is hockey nuts, I was almost guaranteed to be recognized. Which meant I could get anything. Within reason, though reason can have a shifty boundary. A hockey player in Canada in high summer can pretty much do whatever he wants. He can take all his clothes off and dance naked under the moon on the deck. He can fuck, drink, snort his mind out in the bedroom, on the beach, in the parking lot. You have your pick of women, married, single, and in between. And if your taste runs to men, well, they're available too. Though, not once in my entire hockey career did I ever meet a player who was out as gay. And that's possibly because the standard insult for everything and everyone in hockey is fag. I mean, you'd have no chance. Hockey players are the hardest partying athletes of the four major league sports, hands down. And summer in Canada for a hockey player is one big buffet of sex and drugs and rock and roll. At that age, I also wanted to be recognized. And I came to like talking to starry-eyed Canadians. I mean, that was me in Los Angeles a couple of weeks earlier, about the NHL and what it was like, and did I know Stevie Y? Yes, I know him. He's my fucking teammate. What's he like as a person? He's the kind of guy I'd like to be if I weren't me. I didn't actually say that, but it was true. That summer, I spent a weekend with Steve and his awesome wife, Lisa, at their incredible home in Muskoka. They lived in the compound that housed the former Hudson Bay family home and had been redone by Lisa, who has great taste, and in the world of hockey wives, that means she basically created the word taste. She could do that because she was married to the captain of the Red Wings and one of the greatest players in the history of the NHL. In other words, Steve and Lisa were allowed to stand out. The trouble with hockey wives' taste could be nature, but a lot of it is nurture. When you walk into players' homes, They look like they're a recreation of a Pottery Barn showroom. They're all the same. And even if a woman has great taste, it's dangerous to express it because then it might seem as though you think you're better than them, which is a big taboo. The last thing the league wants is for players to become powerful, or worse, interesting. Sergei Fedorov, who was hardly a rebellious outsider, would go to Paris in the summer to be with his girlfriend, tennis player Anna Kournikova, and rather than see this as a guy enjoying the bigger world, other players would assume he was putting on airs. But Lisa and Steve epitomize the concept of happy family, and they are a rarity in pro sports. I wonder to myself during that weekend if I will ever have what they have, with the only exception being that I am starting to fantasize about meeting a woman who is powerful and successful and beautiful and not Canadian. My reason for her not being Canadian is that I'm starting to crave exposure to the rest of the world and don't see myself on the lake every summer for the rest of my life. Of course, neither might a Canadian girl whom I could love, so the idea has a few holes in it. But the main point is that after New York and LA, I am beginning to imagine my life on a much bigger stage. That notion came home to roost at an end-of-summer party we had at the Beaches house. As the festivities rolled along, people started to complain about someone locking themselves in the washroom. When people would knock on the door, all that came back were grunts. This went on for 10 minutes until I'd had enough and started to bang on the door, telling this person, who I assumed was an invited guest, to wrap it up and get out of there. All of a sudden the door opens and some girl is sitting on the toilet, weaving in and out of consciousness. I made the decision to call the cops and have them take care of it so nothing would go wrong on our end. I didn't know what she'd ingested or how seriously she was impaired, so I left it to the pros. To this day, I have no idea who this girl was or where she came from. But I hope if I have a daughter, she never gets that wasted. It was a pretty stark reminder of what I wanted to leave behind and what I wanted to accomplish. It made me focus even more on making the upcoming season the best one yet. Chapter 7. 2 is the most dangerous lead in hockey. In September 2002, after what seems like the longest summer of my life, but is actually the shortest because we played until June, I go to the Red Wings training camp. This year, I don't have to go to rookie camp. I get to report to the main camp, like the rest of the guys who play for the team that just won the Stanley Cup. Things have changed a bit. Scotty Bowman has retired, and one of our assistant coaches, Dave Lewis, is now the boss. And just before the first game of the season, I find a poem in my dressing room stall, as do all the other Red Wings. It's from Dave Lewis. It's about a page long, and it starts like this. This is the time. This is the time when it starts. This incredible dream, it never goes away. It was something so unique that even guys who'd been playing for 15 years had never seen it done before. And since Dave left the poem in our stalls just before a game, we didn't sit back and talk about it. But maybe that was the point. He'd coached for so long with Scotty, who used to do things to distract guys from thinking so that they could just play. So maybe this was Dave's way of doing the same thing, literally getting us on the same page as him from the start of the season. Later in my career, when I was with LA, Andy Murray would put quotes in his daily notes to us, and you'd pay zero respect to them because you knew Andy was just ripping them from some quote website. It was his way of trying to motivate a bunch of guys he had no idea how to motivate because he'd never been in our shoes. Dave Lewis played 15 years in the NHL, and he wrote a poem for us. We paid attention. Dave Lewis had a tough job because not only was he taking over from Scotty Bowman, but he'd been an assistant coach with the Wings since 1988, after retiring from the NHL. The assistant coach's job, among other things, is to bridge the relationship between the head coach and the players. When you move from assistant to head coach, you have to adjust your friendship with the players because now you're not the bridge. You're the boss. Dave was an outgoing man of few words. He was pleasant and personable, but he didn't yammer at you with nonsense. He knew the game. He knew how players thought, and he knew he didn't need to give us endless tutorials. He just needed to bring out our best. And the Wings were a team that wanted to be the best. So it was a smooth transition between the legend that was Bowman to Dave Lewis. My training camp in 2002 was very similar to the others I'd attended, in that it usually consisted of me playing 3 games with a goal and a couple of assists, a couple of fights, and a 10-minute misconduct penalty for driving the opposing squad so crazy that they were thinking more about how to kill me and less about how to win the game. I feel very confident as the season starts because I know I've raised the level of my game, which is what any player wants to do going into a new season. Now I'd like to raise the amount of my paycheck, too. And I hope the agency representing me does as well. Newport Sports Management is the biggest and most powerful in the sport, and my agent, Pat Morris, did a good job of getting me out of some tough situations I'd put myself in during the course of my career. I'd certainly made him work for his money. Pat Morris was one of the biggest agents at Newport, which, as the largest hockey agency on the planet, is actually a hockey player factory. They sign a lot of players to their stable, from superstars to grinders, and the amount of money you make dictates the amount of time you get from your agent. Morris was close with Chris Pronger, Brad Richards, and the Primo brothers. They were his core group. I wouldn't hear from Pat for months, and then he'd pop up when it was contract time. There were times when I couldn't get Pat on the phone for a few days. He wasn't a former player, but a lawyer. He was a very nice guy, and I honestly believed that he cared about the players. But it was in a business-first kind of way. I'm sure he did stuff for me behind the scenes when I got into my various jams, but I wasn't a member of Pat's inner circle. So we didn't spend a lot of time talking about anything other than money. The only time you ever heard guys talking about their agents was when they were bitching because they couldn't get their agent on the phone, or because they hadn't heard from them in years, if a guy had a long contract. The agency game is a racket, run by the good old boys who have so many side deals with NHL managers that it puts a sports book to shame. And while I get that it's good business in the big picture to keep the GMs friendly, players can't help but wonder, when they get traded or have to go to salary arbitration, whether their own agent is sacrificing them to keep some other more lucrative situation in play. That said, agents don't really give a shit what happens to their players, apart from the guys who make in excess of $60 million. They're all very motivated by an extra 0 or 3 before the decimal point. There's so much that agents could be doing for players to help them make the transition after their careers are done. But mostly, they choose to do things that fatten their wallets. For example, Newport had a financial division where they opened bank accounts and credit cards for players and set up your car insurance and bought bullshit mutual funds that made you a fraction of what a proper family office would. A family office, which is a boutique service tailored to manage the financial life of a high net worth person or family, would also help a player with estate planning and creating a diversified portfolio, the stuff a guy needs when the game is done. Newport took 3% of the gross contract, and then players could pay an additional 2% of assets under management. So a player who had stashed $10 million with them would pay $200,000 for the privilege. They would also charge 20% gross on endorsements. Another example of the greed and laziness of these guys lies in disability insurance. Some players take out this kind of insurance to make sure their contracts don't evaporate should some goon cross-check them headfirst into the boards. Sports agents often obtain this insurance through a broker who may coincidentally, be a former player and who adds a percentage to what you'd pay an established insurance agency. What does the agent get out of this? Don't know. Just asking. I found out that all you have to do is call Lloyd's of London directly and buy your own insurance at a cheaper rate from them. Because that's what my friend Adam Campbell did when he started managing my money and that of other players. Newport Sports is the last place I'd allow my son to be represented. It's a tough call when you're starting out because you need the professional help. But with agencies like Newport, when you really need help, it's not there. If I had a son, I'd send him to Ryan Barnes, who became an agent after his NHL career. I know that if he had 50 players on his roster, each and every one of them would get his full, honest attention. He knows the game, and he was the best of teammates. And he understands better than anyone that a player never really knows how long the ride is going to last until it's all over. Most players don't see the end coming, and most don't have any help planning that transition. I know that Ryan does because he's been through it. There were times I got frustrated enough to think I should go into the sports management business when I'm done playing, which is another way of saying be careful what you wish for, because I got sent down to fucking Cincinnati again shortly after the 2002-2003 season started. Did I see this coming? Nope. It was like I just poked my head up to look at my second season as a secure NHLer, and the Wings had whack-a-moled me. It hurt, but I had to look at it like a professional. Plus, it wasn't really a big surprise. Not when you looked at the lineup the Wings were dressing in October 2002. Chris Chelios, Mathieu Dandonneau, Pavel Datsyuk, Chris Draper, Sergei Fedorov, Yuri Fischer, Thomas Holmstrom, Brett Hull, Igor Larionov, Nicklas Lidström, Kirk Maltby, Darren McCarty, Luke Robitaille, Brendan Shanahan, Henrik Zetterberg. If I'm Dave Lewis looking down the bench to see who goes on the ice next, I'd be embarrassed by the richness of choice. Lewis was a very good coach, but even John Tortorella would have to work awfully hard not to win with this crew. Still, he could manage it. And while I was very, very disappointed to be back in Cincinnati again, I knew it was just a matter of time. The Red Wings sent me down to get in some games while they got rid of some bodies and contracts. And sure enough, I was called back up at the end of October. And then the Wings told me the magic words, find a place to live. I was ecstatic. This meant I was going to be around on a more permanent basis. Although at this point in my career, there were never any guarantees. So I kept a travel bag packed, just in case. One day in the dressing room before practice, Brett Hull asked me where I planned to live. I told him I didn't know. So he said, why don't I ask Darcy if you can live in the apartment above my garage? I accepted on the spot. Brett rented a house behind the Blockbuster Video in downtown Birmingham, which was a hip and fancy suburb of Detroit. Everybody called his place the jukebox because that's what it looked like. I mean, it had fluorescent lighting around the border. There were certainly occasions when we made the place rock. The daily routine was fairly consistent. In the morning, I'd always pull either the Firebird or the Navigator out of the garage into the driveway and turn the heat on so it was warm when Mr. Hull was ready to go. We'd make a quick stop at Starbucks, and then we were off to the rink, always being among the first to arrive, just after the trainers and Chelly. We'd practice, work out, and then have lunch with some of the guys. We'd drive home for a nap, and then meet for dinner in whatever joint Brett and his girlfriend, now wife, Darcy, were craving that night. Usually Mexican or sushi. Then we'd hit a movie or head back home to settle in and watch TV. Hully rarely watched sports, with the exception of golf or football. I don't ever remember watching a hockey game with him. One of our morning drives to the rink was memorable because of the wretched state Brett was in. Darcy told me before we left for practice that he'd been up all night rolling around on the floor, moaning and clutching his stomach, and when he could speak, was strongly of the opinion that he was dying. During the 30-minute drive to the rink, Brett was drinking his coffee and trying to figure out what was wrong with him. "Jesus, Aves, I feel rough," he said to me. "Don't know if I can survive a practice without puking my guts out. Think I should just sit in the sauna and sweat it out, whatever the fuck this is." Holly was always game to go, and seeing him like this made me worry. In the end, he decided to battle through practice and told me to hustle up afterwards so we could get on the road home. It was obvious he needed some sleep. As we walked out to the car, I checked my phone and saw that I had 14 missed calls from one of my best buddies who'd made the drive from Toronto the day before to watch the game and do a little partying afterward. When the boys had arrived in Detroit, they'd swung by the jukebox around 5 p.m. to drop their bags before the game. They also dropped some cookies in the fridge and then headed to the Joe. After the game, we had the usual Friday night adventure of wine, women, and general mayhem. Brett had gone home after dinner that night and was delighted to find those cookies my friends had left in the fridge. Well, it turned out those cookies were packed with weed, and Brett ate two of them, which means he ate enough weed to put a guy in the hospital. When he was rolling around on the floor in the middle of the night, he must have truly believed he was dying. I can't fathom what getting that stoned, without even knowing you're stoned, must feel like. I'd waited a few days to tell him, until after he'd buried two goals and notched one assist in a game and was feeling pretty good. Brett was untouchable after a game like that, and you could tell him pretty much anything. When I revealed the source of his near-death experience, he was so happy to know what had happened to him. He thought he had some awful disease that hadn't been diagnosed. He laughed about it even. I didn't expect cookies would be the way I'd get high on pot for the first time in 17 years. And thank goodness he still had the touch. 700 goals and counting. I could have fucked everything up for him. And for the history of hockey. Thanks to my cookie-baking buddies from the north. I was becoming really good friends with Boyd Devereaux, and one day he asked me before practice if I wanted to go see a Canadian band called Our Lady Peace. I've been a fan of theirs since I was 17. Instant yes. Boyd is one of the smartest guys I've ever met, and he's really well-versed in culture, from literature to music to world affairs. He's a far cry from your average puck chaser, and I'm flattered that he thinks me worthy of his company. I also want to learn what he knows. The OLP show was brilliant, as expected, and after the encore, we got to go backstage, which was a big thrill but also a little daunting. I felt like a groupie waiting to meet a stranger whose performance you loved. That can go one of two ways. They could be a total asshole, which would instantly change my perception of their music, or they could be the kind of person you were glad you knew. That night I got lucky and met a lifelong friend and OLP drummer Jeremy Taggart, who, aside from having music instead of blood in his veins, is one of the most fun humans I have ever had the pleasure of knowing and taught me more about music than I could ever dream of. My first real rock star party was courtesy of Bob Ritchie, a.k.a. Kid Rock. And it began as a team bonding exercise organized by Chelly, who was pretty much the team's chief executive of fun. I'd first met Kid Rock at Chelly's Chili Bar after a game, and despite his rock star snarl and American badass persona, I couldn't believe how normal and nice he was in person. At this point, Kid Rock, or Bobby as he was introduced to me, has a few Grammy nominations and is a very fast-rising star in the music world. I find it amazing that I get to meet him just because I play a little hockey, even though I'm no different from most of his 22-year-old fans who like to drink and screw. American Badass is not an act, and what you see is what you get. The Wings were an older team, and a lot of the guys had families. So Chelly put something together for those of us who weren't at home with the wife and kids. We had a few days off between games, including a rare Sunday of rest. So after practice on Saturday, Chelly rounded up about 10 single guys and we loaded onto a party bus. We drove around to our favorite bars, picking up a few people from each of them as we cruised through the outskirts of Detroit, with the final stop being Rock's house in Oakland County, which is about a half-hour drive north of where I was living with Brett and Darcy. Detroit gives way to the countryside pretty quickly, and Bob's house was a beautiful, old, redone farmhouse with a barn. He also had a guest house in which he'd built a studio, as well as multiple bedrooms.